We asked what you hear when politicians like Governor Rauner speak. Here's one response.
I think liar, liar, pants on fire.
And earlier this year, Don Gagne heard another perspective from a Trump rally in Ohio.
This is the double standard between liberals and conservatives.
How so?
Well, you know, the liberals can't, you know, they don't like the truth.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, what's the political divide doing to this country and our state? We're talking perception versus reality. Later, a playwright looks at what it means to be Muslim American on a college campus today. And two engineering students in Illinois weren't surprised by the outcome of the Brexit vote. Why? They built software to analyze social media.
Social media is just, it's just public opinion. It's, people want to put that out there. This is truly how they feel. Having all this content out there that to just dig through is pretty great in terms of predicting certain things such as elections.
That's all coming up on a special Encore edition of The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For this Labor Day, you're listening to an encore broadcast of the program. Today, we're going back to our very first show where we explored the consequences of the political divide. It was this past spring, right after a planned Donald Trump rally was canceled in Chicago. And we wanted to talk about perception versus reality when it comes to what politicians say and what we hear. This polarization is something everyone from political scientists to the White House are worried about. And of course, it's not just national politics. We've seen this play out all year with the ongoing budget dispute between our democratically controlled state legislature and a Republican governor. Right now, let's start with the national scene. The issue of what we hear versus what politicians say was the topic of a Washington Post story earlier this year by White House correspondent Greg Jaffe. Greg joins us from the Washington Post. Hey, Greg, welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You know, I wanted you to be here because you wrote this fascinating story that helped inspire our program today. And it started with two tweets reacting both in support and against President Obama to people who were listening to the State of the Union address. What did they say?
You know, it was just interesting how two people kind of heard what he was talking about. You know, he was trying to talk about polarization and the need for us to sort of come together and listen to each other. And what was striking about the two tweets was just how they heard completely different things. You know, one very much looked at the Republicans in the audience that night at the State of the Union and expressed frustration with them for not clapping or responding to his message in any way. And the other expressed frustration with President Obama, feeling like he had contributed to the polarization and now he was complaining about it after having kind of caused the problem.
And I wanted to play President Obama. That was him during the State of the Union. But he was here in Illinois not too long ago when he was in Springfield. And let's hear what he had to say about the partisan divide at that point.
So you don't have within each party as much diversity of views. And you've got a fractured media. Some folks watch Fox News. Some folks read the Huffington Post. And very often, what's profitable is the most sensational conflict and the most incendiary sound bites. And we can choose our own facts. We don't have a common basis for what's true and what's not. I mean, if I listened to some of these conservative pundits, I wouldn't vote for me either. I sound like a scary guy.
That's President Obama on his recent trip to Springfield to address the legislature. My guest with me right now is Greg Jaffe. He covers the White House for The Washington Post. Greg, how much is the White House worried about what President Obama just said there?
You know, I think they're really, really worried about it. Part of the reason they're concerned is, I mean, certainly the rise of Trump has contributed to that. They look at what's going on in the election, and I think the president is really disturbed by that. He was really disturbed earlier this year when the Republican candidates were calling for sort of a religious test on things like Syrian refugees. And so I think he's worried that the country, if it goes too far down this path, starts to do things that compromise its values. And then I think there's a broader worry that if we can't have normal conversations, if we can't listen to each other, then our political process just doesn't function. And I think there's a feeling in the White House that we're moving precipitously close to that point.
And that's obviously something that they're worried about playing out, not just in the presidential office, but I imagine permeating through all of politics.
No, that was the exact quote from the president's political advisor, David Simas, who said to me, you know, this is not just a problem for us at the national level. It's something that's happening in every state legislature and every town hall in America.
Right, which, of course, we're seeing here in Illinois. How, Greg, you are someone who obviously cover the White House. You're listening to the president's speeches all the time. How is the White House trying to handle this?
You know, it's a tough one for them. They'll say it's a devilishly tough problem. Part of the way that they're trying to handle it is having the president talk to kind of common values that all Americans share. You know, and as that was something he did in the State of the Union. It was something he did in Illinois. It was something he did when he did a town hall meeting on CNN regarding the gun debate, where they had kind of critics of his policy come in and he talked with them or tried to address their concerns. But it's a tough one for them. There are logistical barriers to his kind of hearing people who are different than who have different opinions than he. And then there are just some sort of practical and political barriers.
Right. I know that you talk to a lot of political scientists doing your research for the story, and we did as well. And we spoke to a professor at the University of Illinois named David Tewksbury. I wanted to hear what he said, and I wanted to play for you all. We spoke to him earlier talking about whether or not we're divided as a country, actually. Let's hear what he had to say about that.
The data, we're actually kind of mixed on this. There are a fair number of folks who have said, yeah, we're more polarized when we say things like, you know, more people have strong sort of left or right-leaning opinions. There's some data for that. But then if you look at things like the number of people who align with a Democratic or Republican Party, that hasn't gone up. In fact, actually, the number of people who are independent is still very, very high. And the people going in and out of the Democratic and Republican parties are kind of on the margins. So there actually is less evidence of party polarization, but maybe some evidence of maybe sort of issue polarization. People less willing to talk to each other in a calm manner about particular issues like, you know, abortion or gun control or something like that. So I think it's a mixed story.
That's David Tewksbury, a professor and head of the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois, and he also teaches classes in political science. Greg, when you talk to other political scientists across the country, I imagine they agreed with David, Professor Tewksbury, on that, that we're not necessarily more polarized in our actual political beliefs, just maybe how we're expressing them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of them described it to me like a sports team, you know, that you root against one team's, but, you know, it's not rooted in any kind of particular necessarily ideology or philosophy, but it's just sort of a visceral thing, an emotional thing.
Right. And I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Joe Yoon leads the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab. And Joe, he's in studio with me now. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
You ran a little experiment for us to help better understand some of the social media on how what we're hearing about this. What did you do?
So basically what we did was we took two camps of people that we thought might be separate groups of people. We took people on social media, on Twitter specifically, that seemed to be very much supporters of Bernie Sanders, and people that seemed to be very much supporters of Trump. And we actually, for the past year, we downloaded all of their tweets, and we ran them through a linguistics program that would give us certain person attributes, person type attributes, such as, you know, where do they range with regards to analytical thinking, you know, depending on how their tweets are processed, what's their overall tone, is it positive, is it negative, how confidently do they speak online, et cetera. And what we were potentially expecting to see is that when we compared those two statistically, that maybe there's different types of people that support Trump versus Sanders. But what we found was overall there was not any sort of large statistical difference between the two, that the person type attributes, they were pretty much consistent across both groups.
And I wonder when you think about that, so these person type attributes, I should say, these are sort of standards that psychologists have used for decades. And so you're kind of doing new, more cutting edge research because you're applying this to social media expression.
Correct.
Right? I wonder if the very fact that it's social media, it's sort of a medium where whoever's speaking loudest, it's sort of a medium that rewards people speaking loudly, right? So does that, do you think, skew things?
Absolutely. What's interesting about social media is this concept of influential people on social media. You know, we obviously have people like Taylor Swift or Beyonce that naturally would be influential in the world, and they all are also influential on social media. But what's interesting is that there are certain people on social media, just because of how they've built connections, that although they might be completely unknown on the outside world, within social media, they have grown to become very influential with regards to where they sit in the overall network of the social media feeds. And so when they say certain things, whether it be an extreme position or extreme view, that might actually reverberate very quickly and very powerfully within their realms of social media because of their influence that they have on that medium.
And Greg, I wonder, going back to Greg Jaffe from the Washington Post, Greg, I wonder how you, as we think about how we're sort of, I imagine the White House has put a lot of effort into this as well, right? Because social media, President Obama sort of revolutionized that when he was running for office in terms of how he used that to communicate with people. But now, 8 years later, we're sort of seeing where we are really self-segregating on social media, aren't we, Greg? I mean, I wonder how that changes. Do you think that's changing the tone of political conversation nationally?
Yeah, no, that's a big frustration of the White House. Dennis McDonough, the president's chief of staff, said earlier this year that you can choose your news media the way you choose your neighborhood. You know, you self-segregate so that you're just getting opinions that reinforce your own, and it makes it really hard for the White House to communicate to the country as a whole. So that's something that they're trying to work around. You know, one way they tried to do it after this most recent State of the Union was they had the president do interviews with several YouTube stars who had nothing to do with politics, and that was sort of a way of talking to folks through a different channel, trying to get around some of this.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Greg, as you listened to what Joe did, were you surprised that he didn't really find very much differences between Trump supporters and Bernie supporters?
I actually was pretty shocked. I would have thought that they would have been pretty different demographically and in a whole myriad of ways, so that the sense that they look or sound or have similar attributes. That's really surprising to me.
And when you think about, Greg, when you talk to different political scientists about this, what are we seeing in terms of research? I know when you and I talked earlier, one of the things that was surprising to you was when we look at how we are as a country, we're actually pretty moderate politically. People are kind of picking and choosing their own platforms of things they want. But what are political scientists saying is different about the way we're expressing or the way we're feeling about politics right now?
Yeah, you know, Trump's a good example. I mean, he's all over the map ideologically, right? And his supporter, you know, his conservative Republicans will say, well, he's not really a conservative because he doesn't sort of subscribe to these various views. So in some ways, he reflects that sort of mass that's all over the map ideologically. But what he also reflects is this tone that's very strident, that's very angry, that has trouble sort of submitting to any kind of compromise or any kind of conversation. And that's really what I think political scientists worry about.
Mm-hmm. And how do political scientists say we can change this?
And that's the really hard part. I mean, it's hard to change because if it's a policy-oriented dispute, you know, something that's rooted in sort of fundamental policy differences, you can kind of compromise on that, right? But if it's just rooted in sort of an emotion, a sort of a disgust with the other side, it becomes really, really hard to compromise and really hard to listen. I mean, one way they found is that if you put people in small groups and have, you know, discussions with small groups that are sort of mediated, you can get around this. But it's hard to have, you know, 250 million small discussion groups every year.
Right. Well, we can have a small discussion group here on the 21st show, right? So if you want to share a story about when you learned something from someone you disagreed with politically, if there was a time you were able to cross that divide, you can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Before I let you go, Greg, you know, I wanted to ask you, we often hear democracy is messy, right? And we've certainly heard President Obama talking about examples of how divisive we are with our politics. What have you heard in your reporting about how this moment compares to previous eras?
You know, it's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer to that. I mean, President Obama likes to talk about that. You know, we no longer have canings on the Senate floor. You know, certainly compared
so
to
that's
the devices,
that's an improvement, right?
right, yes. Yeah, certainly compared to the divisiveness of the Civil War, you know, where you have a country that breaks apart and people are killing each other. You know, it's clearly not hard to argue that it's been worse in our history, but that probably shouldn't be the standard that we, you know, try and achieve.
Joe, you know, as we think about this and as you think about the work that you do with social media analytics, I wonder, do you think that social media can help this or hurt this, or where do you come down on all of this?
Well, I think it can go both ways. You know, just this past weekend, as I was analyzing the different conversations for Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, You know, what I realized was one comment somebody made, they said that were in the Bernie Sanders circles, you know, who are all these people that are supporting Trump? And, you know, that really brought more evidence to the fact that what they see is only within their own networks of social media, that's people that are surrounded that are similar to them. And I think what President Obama has done with regards to going to YouTube stars, I think that can actually be furthered on social media, that you could actually identify with regards to these different circles of conversation on social media, find those influential leaders and reach out to them in ways that are beyond social media, maybe in person or whatnot, and really start to kind of, you know, knock away at each one of these groups and just say, hey, can I just join this conversation and can I potentially bring some different thoughts into this so that we can, you know, converse about this reasonably. And I think that might be a way that you could really use social media overall for this.
And really quickly, also, it's interesting generationally, millennials also maybe are much more open, we've seen with research, to listening to different opinions on social media.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. All right. That's Joe Yoon. He's leader of the Social Media Analytics Lab at the University of Illinois. The Social Media Analytics Lab is with the College of Media at the U of I, and we're going to be working with Joe's team throughout this primary and election season to bring their data to our audience at the 21st. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank Greg Jaffe, also, who covers the White House for the Washington Post. Thanks, Greg. Coming up, we continue our conversation about the consequences of the political divide, and we'll turn to how it's playing out here in Illinois. Stay with us. You're listening to an encore presentation of the 21st. Welcome back to an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It doesn't just feel like American politics have gotten more divisive. There's data that actually backs it up. Surveys from the American National Election Study show that both Democrats and Republicans are significantly more likely to dislike members of the other party than they were 15 years ago. We're talking perception versus reality and how this polarization plays out here in Illinois. To take a look at this, we talked to Kristen McQuarrie of the Chicago Tribune editorial board and Maria Nena de Los Angeles Torres, executive director of the Inter-University Program for Latino Research at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Hello. Nice to be with you.
Kristen, let's start with you and where this divide, you know, before the break, we were talking about national politics and where we are and a lot about rhetoric, but I wanted to shift the conversation to the actual consequences of what we're facing here in Illinois. And where are we at right now, 8 months without a budget?
Well, there are two issues kind of swirling right now. You have the governmental problem and you have a political problem. The governmental problem is that we don't have a budget, and so we are starting to see very tangible results of that. Our bill backlog, the number of bills that we can't pay in the state, is climbing above $7 billion. You're seeing layoffs at social service agencies like Lutheran Social Services and Catholic Charities. And these are groups that provide meals for seniors, homelessness support, that rely on state funding and are owed more than $30 million to these two charity charities combined. Then you're seeing state universities, which aren't getting paid. Eastern Illinois University laid off 200 workers last week. Chicago State has declared a financial emergency. So those are the very tangible results of what lacking a budget does to the state. On the political side, the two people who are really warring over that budget are the freshman Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, and the Democratic House Speaker, Michael Madigan. They are at loggerheads in the primary tomorrow. We're part of the mini Super Tuesday. Tomorrow is our primary election, and they are fighting each other in a lot of districts around the state, putting candidates up against each other. So until that is resolved, until we get through the primary, we probably won't see a result to the governmental problem.
That's Kristen McQuarrie from the Chicago Tribune. Nena Torres, you're at UIC. I mean, where are you seeing this play out at the university level?
Well, we're the only public research university in the city of Chicago, and most of our students are actually first-generation college-bound. We educate working-class students from across the state, and we are having to dip into our reserves in order to pay scholarship. UIC, we have a very high percentage of students who are on scholarship. These are supposed to be state-funded scholarships. Our reserves are thin. We're a fairly new university. So what we're seeing is the deterioration of our buildings. We are in a hiring freeze in terms of faculty. The faculty at here has not been able to, you know, update some of the basic kinds of infrastructures in the classroom. So what we're seeing is that there is really an abandonment of what was that commitment to public education, and particularly higher public education in the context of the economy that we live in. And I think, Nyla, when we sort of link this to what is occurring nationally in the deterioration in our political systems and in our really our commitment for democracy, democracy relies on institutions. They're the media and on education. And the commitment in the last, I would say, 30, 40 years has been diminishing, particularly in higher education. And so it is, I mean, I think the results of what we're seeing, obviously there were decisions by the Republican Party that we can talk a little bit more about, maybe indecisions from the Democratic Party here in the state of Illinois. But most importantly, it's the deterioration of the institutions of democracy.
Kristen, do you think that people are so busy blaming each other's party that maybe the sort of the average person isn't necessarily holding both parties accountable for what's happening right now at the state level?
You know, I think at the state level, it's the public has become much more educated and in tune with what's going on. So I think people, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on, except for those outliers who are, you know, way to the left or way to the right, I actually think people are spreading the blame around. I think people understand that Governor Rauner has, you know, really come after public employee unions. He's trying to negotiate over things that people believe are not budget-related in the middle of a budget negotiation. People understand that. They also understand that, you know, he came to Springfield to shake things up, to turn this economy around. And so you can't just keep giving Springfield a blank check. If you're going to raise taxes, it has to come with reform. So I would say that more often than not, at this point, because it's been going on for so long, people do see both sides.
And I know we were talking earlier about how when we look at where we are as a country, sort of our ideology, we're kind of all over the map politically, and people sort of pick and choose issues they want. Kristen, I wonder how you see this being expressed in Illinois, and particularly being such a state that's been known to be such a Democratic stronghold. I wonder how that plays out if you're a Republican in Illinois, and particularly for the politics of our new Republican governor.
Well, it's interesting because I think you see at the state level what you see at the national level, people who are very loyal to either party, but particularly in this state, the Democratic Party, where they have blinders on a little bit because we didn't get to this financial crisis overnight. This has been building for, you know, the past 20 years, and 12 of those years, Democrats had exclusive control over state government, and they just continued to spend more than what was coming in. They also have a supermajority. They could pass a tax hike or whatever they wanted to resolve the problem. But you still have people who are just so loyal to the brand that they kind of refuse to acknowledge that, in the same way that you have Republicans to some extent on board with Governor Rauner and unable to see where he has had some missteps. You know, we are a pretty blue union state. Some of our public employee unions in this state are among the most powerful and influential in the country. So coming out as soon as he was elected and kind of going after that base was probably a mistake on his part. But to your point of state versus national, I think you do see that where, you know, people will only want to watch Fox News. People will only want to watch, you know, the liberal side. And it's the same here where you have some Democrats who are so loyal that they kind of fail to see the larger picture and on the Republican side as well.
But if I can jump in on this.
Go ahead,
one,
Dana.
Nyla,
mm-hmm.
I think that we also had a tradition of moderate Republicans. And if there is one major change in the landscape, is in the Republican Party itself. I mean, we also, you know, we had the Jim Edgards and Jim Thompsons of the world that were moderate Republicans that were fiscally more, if you will, conservative than the Democrats were, who tried to bring in reform to the state level, but in such ways that did not destroy the entire fabric of state government, both its safety net as well as its responsibility and its role in the economic development, including the educational piece. So I think that if we see, you know, historically speaking, again, in the last 25 years, has been this dramatic kind of change, sea change in the Republican Party itself, to where we do have a governor that is slash and burn. And I think that is the most drastic, if you will, change that I've been able to note in state politics.
Kristen, do you agree?
I mean, I would say part of that, yes, I do agree. But I think the movement to a more conservative Republican Party is in reaction to the overspending and the years of, you know, not properly funding pensions. And so people are not looking for a moderate governor who's going to kind of like go along with the Democrats anymore. They want someone who's, you know, going to drop the gauntlet because we're a mess. I mean, our state is not paying its bills. Our credit rating keeps getting dropped. We are borrowing money to pay day-to-day expenses. We can't pay for kids who have autism. I mean, that's not Bruce Rauner's fault, in my opinion. That is years and years of overspending. And because of that, the Republican Party has gotten more extreme and has moved to the right.
Right, and I would say, I mean, we pay one of the lowest income taxes in the entire country as well. So as long as the revenue part of this is not taken up by both parties, we will continue to be having these kinds of fiscal issues.
Well, and as, I mean, the policy debate aside, as both of you are sort of presenting both sides of this, I wonder to ask about tomorrow, an election day. Kristen, let me start with you. How much do you think of our local races tomorrow are a reflection of first of all, let's start in Chicago. I wonder how much you think that's a representation at the national level of a referendum against Mayor Emanuel.
You know, I really don't see that we have one Cook County state's attorney's race that it kind of is a reflection of Emanuel in the sense that we had major protests over the shooting of Laquan McDonald and the way that case was handled, and you might see a turn in the state's attorney's office that pivots basically on that case. But other than that, I have not. The mayor has been kind of lying low, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen too many. Aside from that one race, too many races that are sort of a reflection on him.
What about for the rest of the state? How much more do you see local races being a referendum against Governor Rauner?
Very much so. I mean, because you have, you know, the Democratic Party against the Republican Party in the state for years, the Republican Party didn't have as much financing because they are not in power, and we all know special interest groups, whether they're right or left, they fund the people in power. So the Democrats have always been able to outspend the Republicans. This is one of the first times where Republicans, because we have a billionaire governor who is funding a lot of these campaigns, is able to try to go head-to-head with the Democrats. So in a few key races, it's basically Rauner's credibility on the line. I mean, he's trying to fight back some people who he sees as you know, obstructing his agenda, et cetera. And so if he loses some of these key races tomorrow where he's spending a lot of money, it will be a serious setback for him as governor.
Nina, what's your sense of how people are feeling about tomorrow in the election?
Well, I think one thing to watch is what's going to happen in the city of Chicago in the Democratic primary. And I do think that there are a lot of the forces around the Chuy Garcia candidacy are rallying around Bernie Sanders. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in that particular race. You know, I think that, again, we just had, you know, the visit of Donald Trump to the University of Illinois canceled last week. I think there's, you know, tensions are flying high. I think people are not finding their voice in a certain sense in any one of the Democratic Party's candidates. I mean, in And I think, again, you know, you probably talked a lot about the Bernie Sanders, but I think that there's still people feeling that they're not quite reflected. And on the other hand, I think that there are people who feel that they've been left out and are expressing their anger and their alienation through the Trump. I think this is going to be a heated summer, and I don't see where the decorum that is necessary for democracies, I'm not sure where that's going to come from. And I hope that the media, and I'm not talking about newspapers here.
Or public radio.
Or public radio. But, you know, it's like fanning the fires, and any little thing gets turned into this huge controversy when, in reality, not everything is a huge controversy. Some things are just disagreements.
Ladies, we just have a few more minutes left, and I wanted to wrap up by asking both of you how much you think this local and national election is a turning point in our country in terms of in terms of what we believe in. Kristen, let's start with you.
Wow. I mean, to think that we are at this point where we got through Super Tuesday, we're about to hit mini Super Tuesday, and our state is still sort of at play, and Donald Trump is the nominee. I mean, I think it just turned the whole political apparatus on its head. The media was wrong. The pundits were wrong. The money didn't necessarily win this one, because Jeb Bush was outspending in almost all those early states, and people just kind of assumed this was going to be Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, and then Bernie Sanders is hanging in there. So I just think it sort of blows up the whole model and shows us that, you know, you can't just listen to media people, myself included. You know, we don't...
Is that an advertisement to not read the Chicago Tribune?
We misread the anger in this country. And so to me, it's just kind of, we're hitting the reset button.
Nina Torres?
Well, I was raised in Texas, so not that I necessarily always want to be right about these issues. But I think that there has been a long strategy here, particularly on the part of the Republicans, it was a Southern strategy. And it was a strategy that was based on, number one, taking away your people who were upset about the civil rights movement, and that the Democrats were, you know, going into more integrationist, if you will, kinds of perspective. That has been building up. They also reached out to the Latino community, which is kind of interesting, because a lot of people talk about the Southern strategy, but they don't talk about the outreach that Republicans did to the Latino community. At the end, those two, if you will, almost irreconcilable sets of groups set up for this kind of tension, I think, in the Republican Party. And the Democrats, frankly, have taken the Latino vote for granted and the African-American vote for granted. And so I think that, in part, you know, the other part of elections that we haven't really touched upon is the money that goes into this. You know, as long as it is true that money doesn't always count, but money does matter in elections. And so I think you have a combination of parties that have, you know, taken for granted groups, but not really given them voice. Others who are now shunning them.
That was Kristen McQueary of the Chicago Tribune editorial board, and Maria Nena de Los Angeles Torres, executive director of the UIC InterVarsity Program for Latino Research. Stay tuned to this Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. Special Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. From the attacks in Nice to the mass shootings in San Bernardino or Orlando to Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's calls to ban Muslim immigrants, many are grappling with what it means to be a Muslim American. Playwright Nicole Anderson Cobb's previous work, Tangled, took on the issue of gun violence in Chicago. Now she's turned to a fictional college campus, which I must say looks a lot like the University of Illinois, to specifically explore the Muslim American college student experience. We spoke to her earlier this year about her play. It's called Campus Jihad, The Struggle Within the American University.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, your play opens with President Obama's seminal speech at the American University in Cairo back in 2009, and I thought we should play a little snippet of it, the part that you opened the play with.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect, and one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition.
What role did President Obama's words play in you creating this?
You know, it's a great question. That comment from the president really, I thought, would set a beautiful frame for his presidency, but also kind of a new moment in the American understanding of Islam and the Muslim world. And what has been so striking about his presidency is that his presidency has been really riddled with missed opportunities and kind of continued struggle, as the play is called, Campus Jihad. Jihad in this context means struggle. And I think as Americans, we haven't quite lived up to President Obama's hope for us in terms of relationships between America and the Muslim world.
And when we bring that to college campuses, and in particular this play, there's the line where the two characters are speaking, Angel and Craig. They're two of the law students. And Angel says to Craig, she says, hey, watch your stereotypes. And I think in this play, you have both religious and racial stereotypes, and especially when those religious stereotypes veer straight into Islamophobia and hate crimes, as they do in the play. Would you call that a form of racism, or how would you look at that?
In terms of the kind of misperceptions people have of one another?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
I would hold back from calling it racism, because I believe that racism is a structural and institutional problem. I would call it certainly prejudice. I think prejudice is a really important way to really categorize what's happening between people. And I think that this play really looks at the way in which we misperceive, misunderstand, and really miss out on opportunities to really get to know one another better. And I think the play really looks at intimacy. It looks at students of different races, Pakistani, African-American, European-American, Latino-American. It looks at how we live among one another. We work among one another every day, but we rarely have an opportunity to really deal with each other's histories and each other's presences. We're busy going about the business of learning about the subject matter in class, but we miss the opportunity to really learn about each other.
And then there's this moment in the play, which is not so much, I think, an everyday moment, but a hate crime that happens. This is something that you teach in the Department of African American Studies here at the University of Illinois. Do you think we've gotten to a point where we afford the same level of horror and outrage at religious hate crimes as we do to racial ones?
I don't. I really do believe that we ignore hate crimes, particularly against non-Christian groups, Jewish groups, Hindu groups, Muslim groups. I think those groups are
the Sikh community,
absolutely, mm-hmm. are ignored quite often and need more of our attention. And that has come out for me teaching hate crimes for 5 semesters. I hear those accounts from students who share those incidents with each other. But as a campus, I'm not sure we're hearing students the way we need to help them, to protect them, and to foster better relationships between them.
And that's what I was going to ask you, how you think this plays out differently on college campuses, how you'd like to see better understandings and interactions.
This is a play that deals with the fact that we exist in silos far too often. And at an institution where we really focus on faculty duress, we focus on the duress that happens in the halls of power. This play is a real call to remember the student experience. Students are the reasons why we're here. Students are whose lives we're supposed to invest in most. Not our athletic directors, not our high-paying administrators, but students are who we are supposed to invest in.
There's another moment in the play, Nicole, that I wanted to ask you about, and it's when that administrator is reacting to a hate crime, and he's challenged by one of his colleagues to resist the impulse to make this one student a focal point of action.
That's
and
right.
He's trying to solve the situation. And I think so much when we think about hate crimes or prejudice or overcoming stereotypes, we do want to just fix it.
That's right.
And what was the point of having that in the play? I mean, how would you like to see people approach this better?
One of the things I hope this play does is call administrators to account for the work. Too often, students bring a problem, and I've seen far too often, students are then required to carry the water. And what this play is calling for is adults to step up and do the work. Those individuals who are paid big salaries, those individuals who have tenure and who are secure, often are not the individuals who are pushing the issue. And what I want to see the grown-ups, not students leading revolutions around justice, around equity, around salary disparities. I want to see the adults at the table engage with these issues more.
What about the grown-ups who aren't on campus? What about the grown-ups in the rest of society? Because this play is set in 2010. The Fort Hood shooting features prominently in this. Now I feel like in 2016, we had last year, we had Paris, we had San Bernardino. We have this whole other element of perceptions that Muslim Americans have to contend with. What are you hoping people outside of a college campus take away from this?
I hope that they recognize that they are represented in the play. It's one of the reasons why I have the imam, the religious leader, present, because I want them to hear the voices of people off campus who have their own set of concerns. It's the reason why families are represented, because one of the things I think we ignore is the fact that every student articulates to a larger community. So this absolutely is a play not just for campuses. This is a play about the interplay between campus, community, and home.
Nicole Anderson Cobb is a playwright. Her latest work is called Campus Jihad, The Struggle Within the American University. She's also the founder of Samaritan Road Productions and lectures in the Department of African American Studies at the University of Illinois. And your play, this is being taught in other universities?
It is indeed.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Many were surprised by the outcome of the UK vote a few weeks ago to leave the European Union, but not two Illinois engineering students. They predicted that Britain would leave the EU a week before the vote, and they did it with TweetSense. That's a technology they built to predict vote results. It's based on what people share on social media, on news comments, basically everything that people write online without asking any questions. We're joined by Cody Pulowski and William Wijaya, the founders of TweetSense. The company was created last year when both of them were freshmen at the University of Illinois. William is studying electrical engineering and Cody is studying computer science, and both of them are in studio with me. Hey guys, thanks for being here.
Hello, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Cody, can we start with explaining what TweetSense is and how does it work?
Yeah, so at its core, it's a natural language processing engine with a bit of machine learning. So essentially what we're doing is pulling all of this data that's available online and reading through it and running it through our engine and trying to understand what people mean when they speak about certain subjects. So, for instance, gun control, whether people feel positively or negatively about that, and how subjective their comments are.
William, you are the one who came up with all of this. What made you start thinking about measuring this or trying to understand it better?
Yeah, I came up with this around last year in a statistics class, actually. I was studying education in relation to voting behavior, and I found out, you know, that the way that people have been gathering public opinion, it hasn't changed since 1936, when what George Gallup did was revolutionary, you know, calling people as opposed to sending letters. But nowadays, that's sort of being supplanted right now. Calling is not an accurate way to get people's opinions anymore. The response rates are very low, lower than about 20%. They're not representative of the population anymore. So I had some experience with computer science, and I started building this out with natural language processing, and enough of a minimum viable product to predict the Chicago elections, the Chicago mayoral elections last year in 2015.
So let's talk about that election, because that was actually really close, the final election, right? You're not talking about you're talking about the final election between Mayor Rahm Emanuel and his opponent, Chuy Garcia. That was actually a really close election. And right before, I think there was a lot of concern that people really didn't know how it was going to go. What did you do to measure sentiment? How did you figure out who would be voting for Mayor Emanuel versus Chuy Garcia?
Yeah, that was a pretty interesting one. It turns out we just had to type in, you know, the words Chuy and Rahm in, and then sort of get the feel, the positivity and negativity when people were talking about either candidate. So for an example, like if someone if someone mentioned, oh, I'm not really sure about Chewy's policy on this particular law, then that would bring down his sentiment to a negative amount. And we did that. That was done by our engine, TweetSense, over hundreds and hundreds of comments on social media over the course of several days to get that sort of picture of what people would vote.
So, Cody, what William's describing is actually really hard to do, to measure sentiment, because it's hard to have a machine do that, because there's a lot of nuances to language. People can say things that can be misconstrued as positive or negative. How much human interaction is there with the engine? How is it learning to be able to filter this?
Right, yeah. So basically over the course of the past several months, we've been training our platform to sort of pick out certain errors in language, one of which, something we probably should have thought of sooner, was Trump. The word Trump.
Right, actually, that's a good point, right? Because you would say that's a positive term,
very,
right?
Very conflicting results there. So just little stuff like that we've been sort of picking through, sort of refining our whole analysis process. But for the most part, it's just natural language processing and machine learning on top.
So you guys were at Chicago Tech Week a while ago, and that's when this idea of coming up to use TweetSense for the Brexit vote came up. How did you search for that?
Right. So people were actually coming up to our table just to check us out, and they saw that our whole platform was understanding public opinion. So they're like wondering what people are saying about the Brexit vote, and the fact that the referendum was the day of. They started typing in leave versus stay in terms of Brexit, and the curve for leave was actually positive, not by much, but it was actually a positive slope, and the stay line was, I'd say, it was fairly flat, below leave. And a lot of people saw this and they were like, that's not what people are saying. I don't think that's going to happen. They wouldn't let that happen. You know, the pound would crash, everything, stuff would go wrong. So we sort of, we stayed up pretty late that night tracking
the night
that.
Before the vote, or was this?
It was while it was happening, while the results were coming in.
Okay.
And we kept tracking it on our platform and the actual live poll results. And we were pretty ecstatic about that.
William, how do you want to use this for the election, for the presidential election?
For the presidential election? Really interesting, actually. I just got in contact with someone who potentially wants to connect us with the Gary Johnson campaign. So we could be doing work for actually the sort of third presidential candidate there. Get excellent feedback on what this can do for politicians, what this can do in general in the polling scheme to make it better and understand more. Of course, we're still following the Trump and Clinton election as well.
What's your goal with TweetSense? What would you like it to do?
That's what we're figuring out right now.
Okay.
Ultimately, it's to really change the way we find public opinion. So instead of asking people questions, instead of paying people to do market surveys, instead of wasting a team's time to go around and look at Twitter feeds, should just automatically be able to find people who are already complaining about the issues and finding those people immediately who want to be found, instead of hoping they come to you with random ad buys.
Well, and you also think it's more honest because they're actually just expressing this as a public opinion as opposed to it being solicited.
Right, yeah. So if someone calls you on the phone, say from the Hillary campaign, asking you questions, say you're just naturally a nice person and you sort of give them some slack and you like, yeah, I'll vote for Hillary and whatnot. You know, there's always going to be some sort of bias introduced, no matter what kind of surveying there is. But social media is just public opinion. It's, people want to put that out there. This is truly how they feel. So having all this content out there that to just dig through is pretty great. In terms of predicting certain things such as elections.
That's Cody Pawlowski along with William Wijaya. They're both founders of TweetSense, and they're about to start their sophomore year at the University of Illinois. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much for having us.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.